Okay, well, thank you. I have the absolutely impossible task of following up this year's Nobel laureate. I'll do my best. I actually realized while I was waiting that this is not even the first time this has happened to me. A few months ago, I gave actually this very, very similar talk, also after a different Nobel laureate. That was much worse because that in that case, the Nobel laureate, his purpose was shooting down my talk. So at least as far as I noticed, Duncan didn't do that, so thank you for that. I'll tell you later. Somebody who does not like topological quantum computing, so maybe that's a hint. Okay, so obviously it's a very exciting time for this area, given the recent prizes for foundational work on topological phenomena. So my talk is going to center around what I think is one of the most enticing long-term applications of topological phases, namely topological quantum computing based on systems that harbor Majorana-zero modes. There's been a lot of exciting experimental activity in this area over the last few years, and the basic question I'll be asking is how do we naturally go from the current state of the art in this field progressively towards long-term quantum information applications in a way that reveals all of the interesting underlying fundamental physics. Here's the list of my collaborators. This is a big team consisting both of theorists and experimentalists. The junior people are up top. If you're interested in learning any more about what I say here, you can talk either to Dave Asen, who's a current grad fellow here, or Ryan Mismatch, who is also here this week. So since this is an overview session, I'm going to give a somewhat extended overview of non-Abelian anion physics, so I apologize to the experts. Much of what I say here is general, although I will specialize occasionally to Ising anions, which are the centerpiece of this talk. First of all, non-Abelian anions, they appear in gapped topological phases of matter. And one of the remarkable features that they exhibit is as we start popping these anions out of the vacuum, we get a ground state degeneracy that grows exponentially. So that's a pretty neat feature. If you're not used to thinking about this problem, you might be somewhat unimpressed. You might say, well, I can actually get a very similar counting and exponentially large ground state degeneracy from relatively trivial means. For example, I can introduce free spin of halves into some insulator. That would, in fact, give me very similar counting. So I'd like to highlight the qualitative difference between the degeneracy that we get for a system consisting of free spin of halves and this non-Abelian anion case. So first of all, I can always perform local measurements of these free spin of halves to determine which of these various ground states my system is realizing. That's fundamentally impossible in the context of non-Abelian anions. As a matter of principle, there's no local measurement that I can do to decipher where I'm in that ground state manifold. A closely related property is that I can easily split this ground state degeneracy down here by, for instance, applying local Zeeman fields. Such local perturbations in the case of Ising anions or non-Abelian anions in general are benign and do nothing to this space of ground states, at least if those perturbations are sufficiently weak. So what this tells us is that the degeneracy that non-Abelian anions give us is a rather special kind. Those ground states consist of a set of locally indistinguishable quantum states. Okay, so in the context of Ising anions, which again I'll be focusing on here, you can understand the origin of this degeneracy as arising from Majorana-zero modes that are localized to each of these particles. Those Majorana-zero modes you can think of as being, in a very precise sense, half of a fermion, in the sense that a single fermionic level, two-state level, is shared by pairs of these anions, but those pairs can be separated by arbitrary distances. Okay, so let's go a little bit further now. Let's imagine that we initialize our system into one of those locally indistinguishable ground states, which I'll label by phi I. If we now braid these anions around each other, something quite amazing happens. So that braiding process non-commutatively rotates my quantum state within this degenerate Hilbert space. So here is a braid matrix that quantifies in a very precise way how that rotation took place. And this is the remarkable phenomenon of non-Abelian statistics. So the last property I'll emphasize is a non-trivial fusion. It's a general feature of non-Abelian anions. If you bring two of them together, they can fuse into multiple different quasiparticle types. In the case of Ising anions, which are denoted by the symbol sigma, their non-trivial fusion rule is shown here. What this tells us physically is that if I bring two of these Ising anions together, they can either annihilate each other, corresponding to this identity channel, or they can produce an extra finite energy fermion, which is labeled by this psi fusion channel. There's a nice intuitive way of understanding that fusion rule from the point of view of Majorana modes. Basically, if I bring two of those Majorana modes together, their wave functions hybridize, they'll overlap and form a single finite energy fermion. If that finite energy fermion is empty, that corresponds to the identity channel. If that finite energy fermion is filled, that's the psi. Okay, so ordinarily we often associate non-abelian anions with non-abelian statistics, but I want to emphasize that these two properties, statistics and non-trivial fusion, are intimately related to each other. You cannot have one without the other. For a proof of this, you can check out either of these papers down here. This is actually very useful for the message I want to convey in this talk, because I'm going to argue later on that it's much easier to measure non-trivial fusion rules compared to non-abelian statistics. I think I should actually switch my pointer. I think I'm running out of batteries. Okay, that's much better. Okay, so this is, if you want, the DNA of non-abelian anions. This is, I think, already quite beautiful fundamental physics. The story gets even more interesting when we follow up on Kataev's suggestion for using a system of non-abelian anions to build inherently fault-tolerant topological quantum computing hardware. Basic idea is the following. These ground states are great places to store qubits by virtue of local indistinguishability. That local indistinguishability builds in immunity against local environmental noise, which ordinarily causes decoherence. We can additionally process that quantum information also in fault-tolerant ways by braiding operations because of non-abelian statistics. And finally, we can exploit non-trivial fusion to eventually read out the quantum information at the end of some computation. This is a beautiful idea, a very elegant way of trying to circumvent the infamous decoherence problem. But what we still don't understand is how do you actually build the hardware that goes into bringing this idea to experimental life. On the next slide, I'd like to give my personal perspective on some of the key developments that have taken place over the past many years that are now that have influenced how we're trying to answer that key question. Okay, so if we go way back to the late 1980s, this is when the idea of non-abelian anions were born, at least as a theoretical possibility, from luminaries like Morin Seiberg, Witten, and others. Beginning in 1991, potential experimental realizations began to appear, first in the context of the famous Mohr-Reed quantum Hall state, and then some years later in the context of topological superconductors, both in 2D and 1D. Both of these topological superconductors harbor Majorana zero modes. In 2D, they're bound to vortices, superconducting vortices, while in 1D, they just sit at the endpoints of this topological phase. And we now know that we can exploit either of these systems, the Majorana zero modes in either of those systems, to realize non-abelian anion physics. The next important era in this problem is what I'll call the design era. So beginning in 2008, theorists began to come up with lots of clever ways of combining materials that we already understand and that we already have access to try to engineer the physics of these topological superconductors, which might otherwise be very difficult to find if you're just trying to rely on some internal dynamics of a system. So there are many, many proposals of this kind, probably of order 100 or more papers have been written since 2008. I'm going to focus just on one particular route, which is going to be relevant for my entire talk. In particular, if you want to build a realization of a one-dimensional topological superconductor with Majorana modes sitting at the ends of the system, these two groups showed a very appealing way of doing that. You can take a one-dimensional semiconducting wire, drape it next to a conventional S-wave superconductor, of which we have thousands of examples, introduce a magnetic field, and those ingredients are all that you need to start getting the hardware for topological quantum information processing device. So that's pretty amazing, I think. You know, these are all just completely conventional ingredients. So these kind of designer topological superconducting proposals have generated a lot of experimental activity, particularly in the context of these nanowire devices. These experiments began to appear in 2012, and in the few intervening years from then to now, experimenters have gotten extremely good at building these kinds of devices. They basically mastered the material science of semiconductor-superconductor interfaces. As the sample quality has improved, the experimental evidence of Majorana zero modes in those systems have gotten increasingly quantitative and increasingly, I think, compelling. This is basically where we are now in this problem. I think there's really reasons to be quite excited about near-term opportunities. I think it's very reasonable to begin thinking about the next era of this problem, which will hopefully transcend the problem of Majorana detection and focus instead on doing Majorana control-related experiments that start to identify lots of interesting physics that these modes underpin and start to work our way up towards applications. Okay, so for the rest of my talk, I'm going to propose some ideas for how we can accelerate efforts towards that Majorana control era. I'm going to do two things in this regard. So first, I'm going to introduce a new all-electrical scheme for reading out and manipulating Majorana modes in these nanowire-based devices. I think it's pretty reasonable to try to borrow as much technology as we can from existing experiments, and that's exactly what I'll try to do for this part. In particular, I'm going to leverage experimental tools that have long been available in the quantum dot and spin qubit community, and then port those tools over to the Majorana problem. Okay, so armed with that new control scheme, I'm then going to describe a series of proposed experiments, each of which I think is revealing an important aspect of Majorana physics that's directly relevant for quantum computation. First, I will propose a protocol for revealing the non-trivial fusion rules that Ising and Eons obey. Then I'll get to the question of how can you validate a prototype topological qubit, and exactly what I mean by that I'll be more precise about shortly. And finally, at the very end, I will say briefly how one can use these ideas to implement braiding. Okay, so let me start with this control scheme. This is the basic setup that I'll be using throughout. I'm going to show you many, many pictures of this type, so let me step you through what each component here represents. First of all, the backbone of this device, this gray thing underneath, that's a semiconductor nanowire, like indium arsenide, for example. This orange region up top, that's a mesoscopic superconducting island. You might imagine something like aluminum. The fact that it's mesoscopic is very important because I'm going to try to invoke quantum physics in this region. There's going to be a nearby gate electrode, which allows me to tune the average electron number on this region of the system. I'm going to introduce a magnetic field, which according to these two recipes is necessary for getting Majoranas in the system. All right, so if you're not familiar with the details of why these proposals work, it doesn't really matter. Just for my purpose, all I need to know is that magnetic field, superconductivity, and semiconductor wires is all we need to get Majoranas in this setup. Okay, so this blue region on the left side, that's going to be a trivial bulk superconductor. So there's never going to be anything topological or Majorana-related in this part of the system. Any Majorana physics, if present, is going to sit on these mesoscopic superconducting islands. Okay, so this trivial bulk superconductor and this mesoscopic superconducting island, they form a Josephson junction. I will phenomenologically model the properties of that Josephson junction with the Hamiltonian sketched up here. This first term is just the Josephson coupling between these two regions. So phi hat is the phase difference. So this term basically shuttles Cooper pairs across that island with a corresponding energy scale Ej. The second term is a charging energy piece. So here's where it's important that this is a mesoscopic island. So Ec is the corresponding charging energy. N hat is a number of electrons on this island. And an offset is a gate tunable offset charge, which I can modulate with this gate. Okay, so the final all-important ingredient that I'm going to build in here is this thing I call a gate-tunable valve. Basically, that gate-tunable valve is a nearby electrostatic gate, which allows me to control the properties of this barrier between those two superconducting regions. So if that valve is closed, what I mean by that is I've adjusted the nearby gate to deplete carriers from this barrier region. Physically, that's like physically cutting these superconductors apart from each other. In that limit, the Josephson energy is clearly going to be zero. And I just, in this island, I basically get just an ordinary island behaves like a quantum dot, which is dominated by charging energy and has a unique ground state determined by, with the charge determined by the gate voltage. Right. So there's no topological degeneracies or anything in this closed valve configuration. Now, if I open the valve, what that means is that I restored carriers to this barrier region. That turns on the Josephson coupling between these left and right superconductors. And I'm going to assume that the Josephson energy that we can achieve is much larger than the charging energy. In that case, the charging energy is basically quenched. We lose the Coulomb distinction between different charge states. And it's in this regime where I can get good Majoranas on this island as long as the chemical potential is appropriately tuned in the adjacent part of the semiconductor. Okay, so I want to emphasize that the charge eigenstates that I get in the closed valve configuration on the left are smoothly and uniquely connected to the degenerate parity eigenstates that I get when the valve is open due to these Majorana zero modes. Okay. So that connection allows me to both initialize and read out my Majorana states in a very useful way. So for example, let's assume that you begin in the unique ground state of this quantum dot-like closed valve configuration. If you now move to the right here and open up that valve, that unique ground state uniquely gets converted into a particular parity eigenstate of this open valve configuration. Conversely, if I want to read out which particular state is formed by my Majoranas on the right-hand side, I can move the other way. I can close that valve, restore charging energy, that those parity eigenstates get converted into non-degenerate charge eigenstates that I can then read out using standard technology from Coulomb blockade studies, from spin qubits and quantum dot experiments. Okay, so if I go a bit, let me go a bit more complicated. Let's consider a device that has now two superconducting islands and three gate tunable valves. So now I'll show you that there's actually a lot of flexibility that we can get by just manipulating these three valves. If all of them are closed, then basically I just have two independent quantum dots, one quantum dot here, one quantum dot here. Each has a unique charge ground state. There's no degeneracies or anything like that. If I open up the middle valve, I can basically join those two quantum dots into a single quantum dot that's roughly a factor of two bigger, but still there's no degeneracies. If I open the outer valves, then I can convert that single dot configuration into a single long topological superconductor that extends across the length of this wire, and I'll get one Majorana mode on the left side and another Majorana mode on the right side. And finally, if I close the middle valve, I can cut that topological superconductor in half, which then gives me an extra pair of Majorana modes opposite that central valve. There's a lot I can do here, even with relatively simple single-wire geometries. And in fact, the configurations that are accessible here suffice for two of the three experiments that I'll be discussing, in particular demonstrating fusion rules and validating a prototype topological qubit. Now, these same ideas extend straightforwardly to more complicated geometries featuring multiple islands. And towards the end, I will describe how to use this T-junction-like configuration to implement braiding. Okay, so that's the control scheme that I'm going to use. Let me now turn to the first proposed milestone experiment, which is, again, detecting these Ising-Enyon fusion rules. So once again, this is the key equation that I'd like to have experimental validation of. This is the idea that if I take two Ising-Enyons, bring them together, I get two possible ways in which they can fuse. Either they can fuse into the vacuum, or they can give me an extra finite energy fermion. Okay, so I'm going to propose a protocol for revealing that fusion rule using just this relatively simple two-island single-wire device. The basic strategy here is going to be to manipulate those valves to pull out Ising-Enyons from the vacuum, and then to fuse them in prescribed ways, and then we'll try to see what happens as a result of that fusion. So I'm going to do this in two ways. One is going to be, the first way is going to be not very interesting. It's kind of a boring control experiment, but you'll see why this is useful hopefully shortly. All right, so let's begin with this configuration up here, where this is what I called the single dot earlier. The outer valves are closed, the middle valve is open, and I just start with my system initialized into the unique charge state for that single quantum dot. Okay, so the first step of this control protocol is to close the middle valve. Now I've gone from a single dot to a double dot, and I now have once again a unique ground state that has charge Q left on the left island and charge Q right on the right island. Now I'm going to nucleate some Majorana zero modes by opening both of the outer valves. That basically converts this Coulomb blockaded region into a topological superconductor, and similarly for the right side. The way you should think about this step is that I've pulled out one pair of Ising anions from the vacuum in the left island and another pair of Ising anions from the vacuum on the right island. I'm indicating which of those pairs were pulled out of vacuum by dashed lines. So these guys are connected in that fashion, and so are those guys. Now that I have my effectively Ising anions, I want to fuse them. And I'm going to fuse them in a trivial way by simply restoring charging energy on each of these islands by reclosing the outer valves. Okay, so this is the configuration that I land in. Not surprisingly, the system just retraces its footsteps, and I return to the same configuration that I had up here, where once again I have charge Q left on the left island and charge Q right on the right island. If you now use charge sensors to measure how much charge is on each of these islands, you'll get a deterministic answer. And if you repeat this experiment a million times, you should get exactly the same reproducible answer every single time. That's not very interesting, as I emphasized. The reason it's not interesting is what I've done is the following. I've basically pulled out two pairs of anions from the vacuum and then just refused exactly the same pairs that I pulled out in the vacuum in the first place. And so the particular way in which I've done this fusion, it blocks the access to the side channel. Okay, so now let's do this in a more interesting way. I'm going to perform exactly the same set of valve manipulations that I did on the left side, but just in a different order. And let's see how that changes things. All right, so let's go back up to the top. I start in a single dot configuration, and now the first thing I'll do is open up those outer valves. Okay, so what that does is it produces a single topological superconductor extending across the entire length of my wire, and effectively pulls out a pair of anions from the vacuum and puts one to the left side and the other to the right side. Okay, so those guys are now connected by dashed lines. So next, I will close that middle valve to cut that topological superconductor in half, and that pulls out a second pair of anions out of the vacuum, but now those two are situated across that middle valve. If you compare this configuration to this one, they look exactly the same in terms of the positions of gates and so on. But I've initialized my system into a different member of my ground state manifold here compared to here. On the left side, those islands are completely disentangled from each other, but on the right, those islands are in fact maximally entangled. All right, so now let's fuse gamma 1 and gamma 2, and let's fuse gamma 3 and gamma 4 by just closing the outer valves and restoring charging energy on those two islands. Okay, so now the entanglement that's present here persists once I restore charging energy. In this case, I'll go to an equal superposition of the ground state charge configuration, Q left, Q right, and a different charge configuration, which has, let's say, charge Q left minus 1 and charge Q right plus 1 on the islands. In this case, if you perform a measurement of the island charges, you'll get a probabilistic answer. In fact, you will get a maximally random readout between even and odd charges. And the reason that this result is more interesting is that I now have access to both the identity and the psi fusion channels. Okay, so this ground state charge configuration corresponds to the identity fusion channel, and this excited charge configuration corresponds to the these Ising anions fusing into the psi channel. Okay, so as a technical aside, there's more than just qualitative information that we get from this protocol. The fact that there's an equal mixture of these two states is not an accident. In fact, this is related to topological data from the underlying Ising anion theory. In fact, one is essentially reading out the absolute value of certain F symbols in the theory, or equivalently some ratios of quantum dimensions. So I think that's pretty nice. One's really getting important quantitative information from the anion theory. So let me make a few comments about this experiment before I move on. This is definitely not probing non-abelian statistics, but this experiment in a very real way is non-abelian. I've done exactly the same I've tuned exactly the same set of knobs on the left and right, just in a different order, and I get a different answer. This is possible largely because we have anions in ground state degeneracy. If you try to get such path dependence with systems that have a unique ground state, it's not going to happen, at least if you do things adiabatically. And I think it's actually not so easy to reproduce both of these set of experiments with non-Majorana-related interpretations. The second comment is related to that. I want to emphasize the importance of this control experiment. Right? If I just show you the right path here, we would have gotten what I think is a very interesting result, but I would have had to encourage you to get interested in getting a completely random answer. Okay, and random answers can happen for a variety of reasons unrelated to non-abelian anion physics. 5 minutes? Okay, good. So I think the fact that we have this, well, for example, you can just have noise, right, which randomly scrambles your charge readout. But the fact that our control experiment gives deterministic readout, I think that would help to eliminate some of those boring noise-related interpretations for the probabilistic charge readout that we get over here. The last comment I want to make is that you don't actually have to use charge sensors to perform this experiment. In fact, we propose a different way of doing this where you essentially cycle through these set of steps in a repeated fashion. And if you do things carefully, you can actually convert the microscopic information encoded in these fusion rules into quantized DC currents. That's what I'm calling a Majorana-mediated charge pump here. That's, I think, the most interesting and probably the most practical way of actually doing this experiment, although I won't say any more about that in the interest of time. All right, so that's fusion rule detection. Next, let me turn to the question of topological qubit validation, and let me tell you what I mean by that in the first place. I'm going to return to this to the same two-island device that I showed you before in the context of fusion. We have four Majorana zero modes once again. So this setup is not only interesting for fusion, but it's also interesting because this device constitutes a minimal prototype topological qubit. A technical aside is that if you fix a global fermion parity for your system, there's exactly two locally indistinguishable ground states that we have access to here. And those two locally indistinguishable ground states give us our logical 0 and 1 qubit states. Topological protection of that qubit is, however, not guaranteed. So there's certain requirements that we need to impose on the theory in order to maintain topological protection. One stipulation we have to make is that we have to look at the system on timescales which are short compared to the typical quasi-particle poisoning time. What I mean by that is that there will in general be poisoning events where stray quasi-particles tunnel into and out of your islands. That tends to corrupt your information. It takes you out of the computational subspace or introduces bit flips, and that's something that we don't want to allow. The second stipulation I need to make in order to rely on topological protection is that the system should be confined to the set of ground states with very high probability. And that assumption will be valid provided we work at sufficiently low temperatures and provided that noise acting on our system from the environment happens only with sufficiently low frequencies. So there are many papers that you can find in the literature that explore how this qubit goes bad when you violate one or both of those criteria. I'd like to look at this problem from a different angle. In particular, let's assume that these criteria do hold. And then let's ask the fundamental question of what kind of experiment we can do to verify the topological protection that sits in that qubit. I think this is a subtle question. It took us quite a while to actually figure out exactly how to answer this in a universal way. Now, when you try to think about this, what you might want a useful thing to have in the back of your mind is a companion trivial qubit where you don't have anything Majorana related, nothing anionic whatsoever. But you can imagine that you have a qubit where you have a similar level structure because you happen to have, let's say, accidental low-energy bound states, okay, which would give you, due to accidental degeneracies, 0 and 1 states separated by a gap, exactly like we have for the topological qubit. Any satisfactory answer that we pose for this question had better be able to sharply distinguish between this topological and this trivial qubit. So as you might imagine, the key to 1 minute. Okay, how rigid is that?
Topologically protected.
Plus minus one. Okay, so I will go quickly here. All right, so the different sensitivity to noise is the key to distinguishing these two qubits, as you might imagine. But actually, finding an algorithm for revealing that different sensitivity to noise is not so easy to do. So our idea was to zoom in very closely to these locally indistinguishable ground states. And if you look closely enough, you'll realize that they're not exactly degenerate. There's actually some residual splitting. The spacing between the 0 and 1 states is only exponentially small in the separation between those 0 modes. There's also some oscillatory factor that accompanies the exponential, which is basically reflecting Friedel-like oscillations for the Majorana 0 mode wave functions. So let's call that splitting omega 0. If you plot omega 0 as a function of the chemical potential, you'll get some sort of oscillatory exponential function as shown here. Basically, as you move from right to left in this figure, you're moving deeper into the topological phase, and the degeneracy is becoming more and more exact. Okay. Now, when I refer to something like this, this splitting, omega zero, what I'm really implicitly referring to is a time average quantity for that qubit. In reality, there will be stochastic variations in the chemical potential, which will lead to random variations in omega zero, and those variations lead to dephasing. Okay. So if we watch, let's say, as a function of time, we might begin at some chemical potential here, but then there's some wigglings of that chemical potential and some wandering of omega zero. So the key thing which I want to get across is that those typical fluctuations due to environmental noise and the time average splitting itself are intimately related to each other in the sense that both are constrained by exactly the same exponential envelope. Okay. So this is a property which sharply distinguishes the topological qubit from that trivial qubit that I showed you before. It's the fact that time average quantities and fluctuations are intimately tied to one another. So this property, this link between time average quantities and fluctuations, leads to certain scaling relations that we can try to appeal to verify topological protection. So if delta E typical is the typical amount by which this splitting fluctuates, omega zero scales like delta E typical in the sense that both are constrained by the same exponential factor. Now, if you ask about the dephasing time T2, in the simplest approximation, this is just H bar over delta E typical. Just by dimension analysis, you can guess that. And so combining these two, we find that there's a scaling relation between 1 over T2 and omega zero. So if you manage to measure the T2 time, you ought to see a similar exponential envelope with oscillations riding on top. Very similar to the behavior we see for omega zero. If I can give you a one sentence summary for this, basically the idea is that as your qubit becomes perfect, the omega zero goes to zero and T2 goes to infinity, but they do so in a correlated fashion. Okay, so I won't go into this in any detail. I'll just say that by performing some sequence of valve manipulations, we can have a well-defined procedure for extracting omega zero and the T2 time. Okay, so can we negotiate, or is it? Okay, so I can be very short here. So to be honest, I think what I've already told you is the most interesting physics content of my talk. So braiding, this idea has been around for quite a long time already, and I can just show you a nice way of implementing this using this valve idea. So I have now this T-junction, so there's left and right islands which are going to form a topological qubit, and then I'm going to use this middle island, this middle leg, to manipulate that topological qubit in a protected way. If we start with all those valves being closed, then I start with my system just being in the unique, having a unique charge ground state with charge Q left here and charge Q right here. I can now initialize my topological qubit by opening up these outer valves. That will initialize my system into the zero state. Now I can just modulate these interior valves here to exchange the positions of gamma 2 and gamma 3. And so this is just, it's so obvious from looking at it that it has to happen. So that single braid of gamma 2 and gamma 3 imparts a pi over 2 rotation and takes my qubit from 0 to 0 plus I1. If you now fuse the anions here and here and here and here by turning on charging energy, that 0 plus I1 gets converted into a superposition of different charge states. And if you do a charge measurement of those islands, you will get maximally a random readout. You have to once again be careful about interpreting. You know, a random answer could arise from various other reasons, unrelated to non-Abelian statistics. In this case, there's a very nice control experiment you can do to rule out, I think, completely convincingly, all such noise-related interpretations for the probabilistic readout here. If you just do two braids rather than one, that imparts 2 pi over 2 rotations, which is also equivalent to a pi rotation, and that just flips your qubit and restores a deterministic charge readout. Okay, so the system would have to be wildly rigged against us if we're going to get both of these scenarios with just random noise. Okay, so that's it. So these are the three milestone experiments that we hope people will be able to do in the near future. These two guys, I think, stand out as being particularly enticing near-term things to shoot for, given that they involve just single-wire devices, which people can already grow very well. Fusion roll detection can reveal one of the defining properties of non-Abelian anions and is a very natural precursor to braiding. And finally, topological qubit validation and braiding experiments, as I've outlined them, they allow us to verify the basic tenets of topological quantum computing in a kind of minimalist framework. Okay, so that's it. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, questions?
What are some of the sources for poisoning in the nanowire devices? And
well,
what are the prospects for controlling?
For controlling, well, there's all sorts of strategies that experimentalists can do. You can put in traps for quasiparticles, basically places where that like to eat up, low-energy places where quasiparticles can naturally end up. A very efficient way of suppressing quasiparticle poisoning is to define Majoranas on an island that has charging energy. In fact, there's a paper coming out by Station Q and various other people, I think tomorrow, that has somewhat related, but different geometries that have, let's say, multiple Majoranas on a single island with charging energy. And now there's a barrier, because if I want to have any additional quasiparticles jumping onto my island, they have to pay a charging energy, which is not present if I had a grounded setup. The existing experiments are already quite encouraging, actually. There's a paper from Leo Kuenhoven's group maybe a year or two ago. It's not in the context of these same systems, but they got parity lifetimes of a minute, I think, which is pretty amazing. That's basically infinity for all this, all practical purposes. So it's a problem we don't exactly know. I don't think there's any measurements in the topological regime that tell us exactly what the limiting timescale will be yet. But there are definitely ways of combating this problem.
Jason, somewhat naive question. So in order to be able to measure the charge, presumably charge has to be well-defined on those islands. Does that assume you're ignoring, for example, Andreev reflection processes? So the moment you move those gates that connect to the normal leads, you could imagine electron coming through. And so I guess you partially answered in response to Sandel's question, something about the charging energy. But in your setup, you haven't mentioned it explicitly. So do you assume implicitly that the Coulomb charging energy is always large?
Well, so the only charge measurements I ever wanted to do in my proposal here corresponded to situations where I had completely isolated an island, and therefore I had a well-defined charge. It was completely cut off from all of the from its environment, and so then charge is a good quantum number, and there's an enormous barrier in that case for charge to leak on. So I think in those cases I can confidently say that the lifetime for that charge state is very, very long. Okay.
Sorry, so this may be a very trivial question, but when in your first setup, when you entangle the two left and right superconductors and then project, you had the wave function was L, left minus charge on the left one increased by one and the other one decreased by one, but there's also a component. The other component, I guess you're only interested in measuring charge mod 2, is that why?
Are you asking why it was, let's say, Q left minus 1 versus Q left
right.
plus 1?
There's also
so this is, I probably shouldn't have even written that. Whether it's Q left minus 1 versus Q left plus 1, that's just determined by the values of the gate voltages that are...
determined by what?
By gate voltages. So I could have made that Q left plus 1, Q right plus 1, Q left plus 1, Q right minus 1. So those values are tunable.
Oh, I see. You mean there's a gate behind it next to each island?
Yeah, so each island has a nearby gate,
gate.
Which tunes the offset charge, and by tuning those offset charges, I can tell you whether the next excited charge state has Q left minus 1 versus Q left plus 1.
But there's a contribution, admixture to the wave function from both?
No, it would be... Okay, so as long as you do things slowly, then you either get Q left minus 1 or you get Q left plus 1.
Well, if no more questions, thank you, Jason, again. Well, let's come back at 2.